Happy Friday.
Happy
and
Friday.
Cheers. Oops.
Yay. Clink.
Welcome to Cocktails and Conspiracies,
welcome.
Everyone. Welcome to our podcast. We have some crazy stories for you today.
Exactly. So if you're new to joining us, Freaky Fridays are like a little tidbit in between our bigger episodes that just have to do with, well, sometimes we'll have a theme. Sometimes we'll just surprise each other with freaky, weird stories. And that is this week.
Yes.
Neither of us know what the other's talking about. We don't have
exciting.
A theme. We just went and scoured the internet and tried to find something really freaking weird to tell each other.
Yay!
And you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going to be good.
It is going to be good.
These are some crazy stories.
So mine has to do with a big family secret.
Ooh.
And like mysterious mafia groups. What
love
does yours
it.
Have to do with?
Mine has to do also with kind of a family and a crazy stalker.
I love it.
Yeah. And it's unsolved. It has not been solved yet. And it's like a recent case. Like it took
really?
Place a few years ago. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want me to go first or do you want to go first?
You go first.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is from BBC News from February of 2018. And it tells the story of Pauline Dakin. And she is just a normal woman, but she had spent her whole life basically on the run, having very weird things happen to her until she found out why. And
ooh.
This is the story of why.
Okay.
So Pauline Dakin's childhood in Canada in the 1970s was full of secrets, disruption, and unpleasant surprises. She wasn't allowed to talk about her family life with anyone, and it wasn't until she was 23 that she was told why.
Dun, dun, dun.
So there was always something weird about her family. Here's a quote from her. My brother and I would say, what do you think is wrong with our family? Why are we so weird? But that was the mystery that just didn't get answered. So her parents were named Warren and Ruth, and they separated when she was 5 years old. Her dad, Warren, was a successful businessman, but was a really heavy drinker who could become violent, and there got to be a point where her mom, Ruth, just couldn't take it anymore. And you know what's so sad is, like, how many freaking stories start out this way?
Never
a 100.
Time. Yeah.
That I could think of, probably at the top of the back, like, my head. So when Pauline, the woman of our story, was 7, her mom, Ruth, took the children on a holiday to Winnipeg. That was more than 1,000 miles from their home in Vancouver. But when they arrived, her mom, Ruth, told them that they were never going back.
What?
Yeah. Pauline says there was no opportunity to say goodbye. It was just this abrupt severing of relationships.
What are they running away
from? So when she asked her mother why they had done this, there was never a good explanation. She would only say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. When you're older, I'll tell you. And the same thing happened again 4 years later. This time the family moved to New Brunswick on Canada's eastern coast. Apart from all the weird moving, life was pretty normal. They'd start again and build a new life in a new town. But below the surface, Pauline, the subject of this interview with BBC, she was confused, anxious, and falling into depression.
Yeah.
She says, I knew something bad was happening. I didn't know what it was, but there was always a sense of something dire that was unspoken. By the time Pauline was 11, she'd attended 6 different schools in nearly as many years and had lost touch with her father. But another man had come into the family's life. A church minister called Stan Sears. Pauline's mother, Ruth, had met Stan at a support group for the family of alcoholics. Stan was a counselor there, and Ruth had gone to him when she was struggling with her husband, Warren's drinking and preparing to leave him. Both times that the family moved, Stan's family, that minister, had moved in lockstep with them. So when they moved originally from Vancouver to Winnipeg, that minister and his family moved at the same time.
And with then when his whole family?
Yeah. And
That's
then when
so
they
weird.
Moved to the East Coast, they moved at the same time.
Don't like it.
So weird. Once in New Brunswick, which is on the eastern side of Canada, they put down roots. By 1988, at the age of 23, Pauline had graduated from university and was working at a local newspaper in the city of St. John when her mother telephoned with an unexpected proposal. She said, "Okay, I'm ready to explain all of these strange things that have happened throughout your life."
Oh my God.
So Pauline was supposed to meet her mom outside of a motel halfway between the two cities they were living in. When she arrived, her mom slipped a note and an empty envelope into Pauline's hands. The note read, "Don't say anything. Take your jewelry off. Put it in an envelope. I'll explain. Just don't talk."
What?
Yeah. Would you not freak the fuck out if your mom...
I don't know what I would do.
I would be like... I wouldn't be cool. I wouldn't do what the note said. I'd be like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be cool at all.
No, I would be the opposite of cool. So paranoid.
I'm not a sheep, I guess.
No.
No. But if it was your mom doing that, and you'd be like...
I know. But she already kind of didn't trust her mom, right? She knew something sketchy was...
This is crazy. It was just the most bizarre thing Pauline remembers. I thought, who are you? What are you doing? But I did what she told me. That's probably what I would have done too. So her mother took her to a motel room where Pauline was surprised to find Stan Sears, the church minister that was a family friend that moved with them every step of the way, waiting for her and her mom in the motel room.
Weird.
Stan and Ruth told Pauline that for the past 16 years, they had been on the run from the mafia and that Pauline's family had been targeted because her father, Warren, had been involved in organized crime. She couldn't wear her jewelry because it needed to be tested for bugs.
What? Like for...
Like listening devices. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was unbelievable, Pauline said, but I remember a feeling of terror coming over me that this might be something we could never escape.
So this is in the 80s when she found out?
Yeah, 88. Okay. She was 23. So Stan, the church minister, friends with her mom, explained that it had all started after he counseled a mafia kingpin who wanted to turn his back on his criminal past. When the mob discovered that the man had broken his code of silence and come to Stan for counseling, they had assassinated him and had then come after Stan, thinking he probably knew too much.
Oh, how scary.
Yeah. Later, when Ruth, the embittered ex-wife of a mobster, had started working as a secretary at Stan's church, she too had become a target. I was told that each of us had somebody following us, keeping an eye on us from a distance, Pauline says, and that there had been many attempts to either kidnap, poison, or kill me, but that these agents, quote unquote, had intervened to keep me safe many times over the years. So basically she's saying, like, the mafia was after them, but there were, like, these government agents that were, like, keeping them safe from, like, the mafia, according to Stan. Okay?
I'm sorry. I'd want to be protected by the mafia, not government agents.
Right. Right. If you've listened to this podcast, you'd understand why we said that.
Yeah.
So, as well as this government-sanctioned task force, a.k.a. the agents that were keeping this family safe from the Canadian mafia, is fucking funny.
That is funny.
Sorry, just they're just so nice there.
Yeah, but they're the nicest mafia.
So as well as the government-sanctioned task force, a.k.a. the agents, Stan also explained that there were shadowy communities, towns or villages in different parts of the country where people who'd been targeted by the mafia could go into protective custody. This was known as the weird world.
Ooh, right. So they're a part of the weird.
They were being protected by the weird world, as well as like these agents from the government.
I don't like
sketches
it.
Five.
I don't like that name. I don't like that.
But
title.
I'm sorry, this has been going on for years. As a kid, like, what are you supposed to freaking think, right?
Oh, my God.
So after years on the run, Pauline's mother, Ruth, said that she was going to go inside, quote unquote, for protection. She was going to disappear again. Stan Sears, the minister that was always around their family, with his family, Stan was already living in one of these communities, like the Weird World communities called Place of Hope. But his wife hadn't wanted to go inside with him. So he was now living there alone and working in this weird world with its agents. This is like what this woman was told when she was 23 years old.
Oh my God.
Stan and Ruth told Pauline this was their chance to finally be together. They had been in love for many years. Who saw that coming?
Yeah, I was about to say.
Right? But they had never been able to act on their feelings. Pauline was in shock. It was just too much to take in. I was sick with fear and sadness, and it just felt like life was shattering all around me. So she spent the whole weekend listening to these stories, which helped explain some of the weird shit that she had been experiencing through her whole life. Like, one time when she was growing up, she found her mom, like, throwing away all of the shit in their refrigerator at once. The story at the time was that the food had gone bad, but I remember thinking ketchup and mustard don't go bad. There are things that don't go bad that quickly. Why would you do that? She thought. Like, she was like, she remembered that as a kid, like, all of a sudden, like, one day.
Why did she do that?
Why is she throwing? I would be scared out of my mind if I came home and my mom was, like, emptying everything out of the fridge, like, frantically, like throwing it away.
All the condiments and stuff that.
But you know what? Kids are dumb. I probably would have believed my mom. She was like, no, you know what? I'm spring cleaning. Like, I'm just cleaning it out.
I mean, I do that all the time. And I had thrown away ketchup and mustard and had this exact conversation with Randy.
Yeah.
They do expire, but they last years.
Yeah.
So wait, so what did she tell her later? Like, what was the reason? Because of DNA?
So Stan explained that they had received word that somebody was trying to poison them. So everything had to be thrown away. There was this time her family had gone hiking in the middle of the school week and stayed overnight in a mountain cabin. People had been coming after them, Stan explained, and they had to get away for a day or two. So, like, growing up, these weird random things would happen to this poor woman. Like, camping in the middle of the week on a school week, like, that's her mom so throwing weird shit away, like, that would freak me out. There was a day where the family had skipped school to go bowling, and the time the children had come home from school and been rushed through the house, told to scrub their feet in the bath and made to wear plastic bags over their socks for the rest of the day.
What? Why?
I don't know. As unbelievable as it sounds, there were all these explanations that made pieces that had been so troubling fall into some sort of pattern and a narrative, Pauline says. So when she left that weekend after Stan and Ruth, like, explained everything to her, Stan asked if he could put a transmitter on her car to make it easier for the good guys, quote unquote, I guess the agents or the weird world, to follow her and make sure she was safe. He also gave her a small transistor radio that he said had a broadcast function so Pauline could send a call for help.
So he's doing it. He's putting all of that.
He's protecting her.
Pauline, not, what's the other girl's name?
Judy? Ruth.
Ruth.
So Ruth and Stan are together.
Okay.
They're together now. Yeah. And they're in one of these communities, that Place of Hope or whatever. That's the weird world that, okay, like, harbors
don't
people.
Don't ever live in a neighborhood called the Place of Hope.
No.
Like, that's
last place of hope you could hope for. So when she was leaving, Pauline goes, he warned me, only use this if your life is really in danger, because people will respond and put their life on the line for you. Pauline returned to the home she was renovating with her boyfriend and to her job in the newsroom. She was a journalist after she graduated college, but she was struggling to come to terms with what she'd been told and growing up fearful by the day. She's constantly looking over her shoulder for people or cars that might be following her, and became too scared to eat at restaurants in case somebody tried to slip her something in her food. She planned escape routes from inside her home and assumed that her telephone line was bugged. Could you imagine living day to day with that anxiety or that fear? Like, everything you did was being, like, trapped or whatever, because your mom and her weirdo friend, like, told you that your whole childhood was filled with weird shit because of this conspiracy.
Well,
could you,
like,
imagine?
Do you trust your mom in this ministry?
No.
Like,
you don't trust
anyone.
No, you don't know what to think.
Oh, no.
I know. It's so sad. Over time, more and more alarming information came from Stan and Ruth about the weird world, including the news that many people they knew weren't really the people they seemed to be.
Oh, no.
What the fuck ever. Like, The story was that some people who had been around us during my childhood who were involved with organized crime had been picked up, arrested, killed, or otherwise disappeared, and then replaced by doubles, Pauline says.
Oh my God.
How many layers of fuckery is in this story?
That's not fair.
But, I mean, would you believe it if it was true or not true? Like, I mean, because we know weird shit exists, but it's like at one point.
But that's so extreme.
Right? And it's crazy.
In Canada.
Right?
What?
The doubles freak me out. Yeah. Sometimes the double was put in place by the quote unquote good guys, and sometimes the double would be put in place by the quote unquote bad guys. So you were never 100% sure whose double it was. It was espionage. Like, what's the actual fuck, right? The doubles, Stan explained, spent months studying home videos to learn how to behave convincingly and use specialist plastic surgeons and makeup artists to perfect their disguises. Like, what the fuck, Stan?
Oh my God.
So basically he's saying, like, they've been trained and they use, like, plastic surgery and behavior studies to, like, perfectly match the people you know, so you can never believe. It's like a weird, like, level up of gaslighting to me.
Yeah. Yes.
Right?
Ugh.
Okay. So Pauline encountered these doubles from time to time. On the day her brother got married, for example, she met her father and her aunt for the first time in years. Both, she told, were doubles.
What?
My mother was so upset at that wedding because her sister was supposed to be a double, Pauline recalls. She kept saying, but look at her toes. Those are exactly Penny's toes. How could you possibly make someone else's toes look like that? So her mom was freaking out too. Her mom was like, that is my sister. I know my sister. Like, but she's supposed to not be my sister. Her mom was freaking out at that wedding.
So wait, but why? Because she was supposed, they were supposed to kill her?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's like some spy, espionage, like spying on them because they were part of this, like, organized crime, like, back in the 70s because of her father, Warren.
But why was she upset that that was not, that that was
because
her
she was
sister?
Told that that was a double, that wasn't her real sister at the wedding.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. So, Pauline remembers looking at her dad that day. So her dad came to her brother's wedding. Who was the alcoholic, who's the businessman at the
Warren,
very beginning,
right?
Warren.
Yeah.
She hadn't seen him in years. Oh, sorry.
No, I think that was me.
No, it's me.
Well, it's both of us.
Oh, yeah, we got the same text.
We're on the same thread.
Yeah. And Pauline remembers looking at her dad that day. He had a nevus, which is a little overgrowth of cells just over the iris of his eye. So it, like, discolors your eye a little bit.
Like inside your eye.
Uh-huh. How on earth could it have been replicated, she wondered, if he was supposed to be a double?
Yeah.
But when I told that to Stan, he said, oh, it's contact lenses and there's prosthetics and there's this and there's that. There was always an answer, she said. Pauline and her mother also received dozens of letters from people inside the weird world, from her father and godfather, for example, who were being held in a top secret prison there, Stan said. The handwriting always looked authentic, and the letters talked about things from their shared past.
Oh, God.
They were convincing. Who on earth would have time to forge them if they weren't real, Pauline wondered. So I have, like, an example of a letter. I won't read it, but we can post it, like, of, like, what she received that was, like, typewritten by, like, a family, quote-unquote family member.
But it was typed.
Yeah, but some were handwritten. Okay. Despite being plagued by doubts, Pauline had always had to acknowledge that the two people telling her this incredible story were her mother and Stan, the most trustworthy people she knew. So could you imagine, like,
no.
You would be... It was like she was groomed. You know what I mean? So she just felt like, if I couldn't trust them, who could I trust?
Yeah.
So she began to feel like her work as a reporter covering school board meetings and town council meetings was irrelevant when her own life was in constant danger. And being sworn to secrecy had placed a gulf between her and her boyfriend and everyone else in her life. So she said, I just thought, I can't live like this. She decided that she would go inside with her mother, like to the weird world or whatever. So Stan.
So this whole time she wasn't, she was just doing her own thing.
She was doing her own thing after she graduated.
And they were trying to convince her, hey, come to the place of hope or whatever.
Right. Okay. So she, yeah.
Okay.
Stan told Pauline that there was work inside that she could do, that there was a community of good people that she could be a part of. He was building a cottage for himself and her mother, and he said he could arrange for one to be built for her too. Ew. He brought her carpet samples and showed her plans and a photo of the horse she would have.
Ew, carpet.
Like,
carpet.
Yeah, same. Pauline left her job, sold her house, and broke up with her boyfriend.
Oh, my God.
She moved to Halifax in Nova Scotia, where she found work and a new home, while she and her mother waited for word that it was safe to go inside. This is fucking nuts.
Like, to officially go inside the...
We were told that there had been threats against family members and that if we were to disappear again, all hell would rain down on anyone left behind, Pauline says. The intelligence gatherers were telling us through Stan, all of this is coming through Stan, that the mob had some sense that we might be planning to disappear, so they were threatening us. We were always on hold.
Stan seems like a sketchy motherfucker.
Yeah. So Pauline met this guy, Kevin, who would later become her husband. Stan gave Pauline away on her big day. Of course, she couldn't invite her real father because he was in the mob.
Oh my God.
And Kevin was allowed in on the dreadful secret. And Kevin agreed he would go inside too. But the time was never right. By 1993, 5 years after she had been let into the secret, Pauline's doubts had reached a climax. I was at war with myself and I wanted to find some definitive way to prove it right or wrong. Good.
Yeah.
I would have not waited 5 years.
I know.
For sure.
Jeez.
Like all this crazy shit, I would have tested this immediately, I think.
She's 23 though.
I know, that's true. So Pauline.
This is like the 90s, whenever people
didn't know shit.
I mean, there was no real internet.
Right.
Oh my God.
So Pauline decided to set up a sting. At a time, she knew Stan was visiting her mother. I called my mom and said, somebody's broken into my house. What should I do? Pauline's mother replied, I'll ask our friend and call you back. Stan had made it clear to Pauline and Ruth that they must never go to the police to report any of the threats and strange goings-ons in their lives. The police couldn't be trusted, he said. If there was any trouble, they should come to him and he would let them know if he got word of any plots that put them in danger.
Uh-oh.
He had a special contraption implanted in his wallet for receiving messages.
Nope.
Like, come on, look in his wallet, right?
Yeah.
So it would do a Morse code dash and dots message and he would then take out a little notepad and decipher it, Pauline says. Like, what the actual fuck? Okay. So Ruth called Pauline back a few minutes later after she set up the sting and said, like, oh, my house has been broken into my house. I was terrified because it was the moment that I was going to get the answer to this horrible quandary I'd been living with, she said. Ruth said she couldn't talk on the phone. Pauline must go to her house immediately, like to Ruth's house. Leave your home that has been broken.
Yeah.
Come to the house. Once there, Pauline listened horrified as Ruth and Stan told her that two people had been picked up just down the street from her house earlier that day, that they had photographs of her, that they had been following her and were looking for certain things in her house.
And she literally made this whole thing up.
When she said that, I knew the whole thing was a hoax, Pauline said,
because
there had been no break-in. I made it up. That was the moment I knew of all of those severed relationships, all of the crazy running, all of the strangeness. It was all a lie.
Oh, my God.
Could it took her a week
imagine?
To, like, confront her mom about it. She was so horrified.
Oh, my God.
But what worried her was that if Pauline no longer believed the story, she wondered if she was putting herself in danger.
Yeah, sure.
So when Pauline confronted Stan, he told her there must have been a mistake. The report about the men who had been picked up after searching her house must have been incorrect. There would be an investigation, he assured her. My memory of that night is how sad he was, she said. I was no longer one of them.
Yeah, because she fucking figured it out.
So Pauline spent months trying to convince her mother that Stan had been lying to them. And while her mother tried to convince Pauline that she was wrong, they reached a standoff and, like, basically didn't talk to, I mean, there's more, but, like, in search for an answer of, like, what the fuck was going on, yeah. like, Pauline went to see, I'm sorry this is long, but this is a crazy story. Like,
yeah.
Pauline went to see a psychiatrist.
Because her mom was probably like, it's all in your head, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah.
I said, what do you think this could be? He, meaning Stan, is clearly not schizophrenic. He does not appear to be psychotic. He's a professional and well-respected. People always talk about what a great guy he is, what could be going on. The psychiatrist suggested that it sounded like a case of folie à deux, a syndrome in which symptoms of a delusional belief are transmitted from a dominant personality, Stan, to a less dominant personality, Ruth. Folie à deux, yeah. Like, we've all heard that saying, right?
I have never heard that saying.
I think it means, and I'm just like, I'm making this up, I'm translating it in my head. It's folie of two. So, like,
yeah, okay.
Right? So, yeah. Like, the folly, like, the lie or the delusion or whatever starts with Stan. The he imprints it on somebody who will take his word, which is his,
oh, you my know,
girl, Ruth.
God.
So, it's a lie. It's a folly. It's something made up. But, like, he makes somebody else believe it that's less dominant than he is. Pauline and her father, Warren, the Ridge, connected after many years, but he was now quite ill with emphysema and he had started drinking again. So Pauline thought about telling him, but then she was like, okay, he's going to make him really upset and mad. He's already super sick. So yeah. There wasn't anything to gain from it. Her relationship with her mom never entirely recovered, although it improved when Pauline had her own kids. So her mom developed, you know, like, they got a little bit better, but they never talked about, like, that moment or, like, all that shit.
Did her and Stan stay together?
Yeah. So Pauline, Ruth developed cancer. My God, that's terrible. Ruth developed cancer, which eventually caused her death in 2010, but she spent the last 9 months of her life living with Pauline, not Stan. Ruth never stopped believing Stan's story, even after his death, when the letters from the weird world dried up.
Shocker.
There were no more messages about the activities of the mafia. There couldn't really be any doubt it had all been a figment of his imagination. Shortly before she died, she tried to warn me to be careful, Pauline recalls. I said to her, I don't need to be any more careful than anyone else. And basically, like, so, like, after her mother passed, Pauline is still trying to understand why Stan had concocted the elaborate hoax that lasted for decades. She came across an article in a medical journal about a condition called delusional disorder. As I read this article, I thought, this completely describes Stan, someone who is in every respect normal and competent, but has this crazy delusion.
And he's a minister. Like, that sucks.
Trusted position, like trusted police position. Officers, ministers,
priests, anything with religion, anything with, like
the law.
Authority.
So...
Jesus.
So basically, like, you know, she contacted a bunch of people and she decided that that's what he had.
But she can never prove it because he's fucking dead.
Right. She says, I feel very sad for my mother. She had such a difficult life and she was vulnerable to Stan, mostly because he was a gentle, caring guy. Too bad he had this terrible delusion. But I also feel sad for myself and my brother, two little kids whose lives were hijacked.
That's so unfair.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh my God.
That's the story.
What's going on with her now? Do we know?
Just trying to probably heal from it. She has her own family.
Probably, like, completely off the grid.
Yeah. Like, I mean, she gave this interview almost 2 years ago. So,
oh my God.
That was the first time she'd ever talked about it. It was February 2018.
Oh my God.
Mental illness is very scary. And manipulation is very scary.
Yeah.
And manipulating children is very scary.
So unfair. And manipulating people that I mean,
putting fear into Ruth, their daily lives.
Yeah, trusted him. He's a fucking minister, you know.
But he had a mental illness. And it's
if ministers or priests have to go through.
No,
they don't.
No,
that's not right.
They should.
If like FBI agents, Secret Service agents, they have to go through legit crazy psychological testing before they're put in that position.
Yeah.
A priest or a minister should have to do the same. I mean, within their own churches, I guess.
Actually, you know what? I don't think I can talk about this because I don't know how you actually become. I think, like, don't deacons, like, get voted on by the parish?
I have no clue. Well, now I'm so fucking paranoid. Oh, my God.
Isn't that a crazy story?
So if we wanted to look it up, what would we type in?
So it's a BBC. Her name is Pauline Dakin. D-A-K-I-N.
Poor Pauline. I hope she's okay. I hope she's on lots of good meds. That fucking sucks.
I know.
No thanks. I mean, if you can't trust your fucking parents, who can you trust?
Right. I mean, could you imagine, like, how much anxiety and, like, stress? She broke up with a boyfriend. They were, she had a real job as a journalist. And, like, they were redoing an apartment together. And, like, because of, like, her weird shit that her mom and, like, Stan said they have, like, she moved in with her family, like... It's like mental illness, mafia, secret society, and cults all in that story.
Wow.
What a banger of
a
story.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
And that's recent.
Yeah.
Mine's recent too.
Let's hear it.
Okay.
Do you want another drink?
Yeah, I'll take a little refill.
Just a little topper?
Sure. Oh, by the way, guys, we're drinking Tito's and Topo Chico.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, for sure.
Good. Okay. So mine's about the Westfield Watcher. Have you ever heard of this guy?
No.
Or a girl?
No.
So this is a story about a stalker that was active as recently as 2017. And it takes place in the quaint town of Westfield, New Jersey. So just to give you kind of an idea of what Westfield is like, many Westfield residents compare their town to Mayberry, which is that idyllic setting for the Andy Griffith show. Like, everyone's friendly. It's really safe. Westfield is 45 minutes from New York and a bit too slow for singles, meaning the town's 30,000 residents are largely well-to-do families. This year, in 2019, Bloomberg ranked Westfield as the 99th richest city in America. And in 2014, whenever this whole story started, it was number 30 on the safest city in America.
So it's just like the perfect, quaint, yeah, North England town.
Just perfect, right? Nothing bad ever happens there. Until June of 2014. Okay. So in June of 2014, Maria Brodus, her husband Derek Brodus, and their three young children had just closed on their new home, 657 Boulevard in Westfield, New Jersey. It was about 4,000 square feet, six bedrooms, $1.3 million house, and it had been described as their dream home. It was located just a few blocks from Maria's childhood home, and in 2014, Westfield, New Jersey, like I mentioned previously, was actually the 30th safest city in America, according to the website Neighborhood Scout. So, just before I start, I got most of my research from BuzzFeed, True Crime Unsolved, and this letter called The Cut, which is an online publication in New Jersey.
Okay.
So, 3 days after closing the sale, before the Brodus family had moved in, a letter arrived in their new mailbox. The letter was in an envelope and had the new owner written on it by hand with a typed letter inside. And here's what the letter read. Dear newest neighbor at 657 Boulevard, allow me to welcome you to the neighborhood. How did you end up here? Did 657 Boulevard call to you with its force within? 657 Boulevard has been the subject of my family for decades now, and as it approaches its 110th birthday, I have been put in charge of watching and waiting for its second coming. My grandfather watched the house in the 1920s, and my father watched it in the 1960s.
Wait.
Now it's my time.
Oh, wait. Let me just say, like, the letter started off as very, like, nice. Like, oh, hi. I feel really welcome to this neighborhood.
Why are you here?
How sweet.
Yeah.
Like, why are you here? What'd you get here?
Yeah.
Like,
hey,
welcome to the town.
Yeah.
But then, like, the force within and the second watcher, right? Like, the fuck?
And who speaks like that? Like, doesn't this seem like it's...
Did your grandfather just, like...
200 years ago?
That's gross.
Ugh. Okay, so the letter continues. Who am I? There are hundreds and hundreds of cars that drive by 657 Boulevard each day. Maybe I am in one. Look at all the windows you can see from 657 Boulevard. Maybe I am in one. Look out any of the many windows in 657 Boulevard at all the people who stroll by each day. Maybe I am one. And then this letter also mentions specifics about the Brutus family. Quote unquote, you have children. I have seen them. So far, I think that there are three that I have counted. Do you need to fill the house with the young blood I requested? Better for me. Was your old house too small for the growing family, or was it greed to bring me your children? Once I know their names, I will call to them and draw them to me. Signed, The Watcher.
Is The Watcher... Like, they just get in this, the house?
No, they just get this random letter before they move in, like, a couple days after they close, and that was what the letter said.
I would be like, call 911. We're not moving in until we know what pedophile is in this, like, fucking neighborhood.
That's not cool.
Did they call the police?
They did.
Okay, thank God.
So they called the police, but right after receiving the letter, because they hadn't moved in yet, they had just closed, the Brutus family reached out to the previous owners of 657 Boulevard, John and Andrea Woods. And they were like, what the fuck, you guys? Like, why did we get this letter? Do you know anything about it? Blah, blah, blah. The Woods claimed that they had never received any letter like that in the 23 years of living in the house.
So they just, like, spent 23 years of bliss, like, just chilling in the house? Nothing?
Well, except once, a few days before they moved out.
Hmm.
While they felt like the letter they had received was odd, they threw it out without much concern. They just threw it away. John and Andrea Woods both mentioned that they never felt watched or threatened in the 23 years they lived in the house. In fact, they felt so safe that they didn't even lock their doors most of the time. Don't ever do that, you guys. So the Woods family went with the Brutus family to the police to tell them about the letters. The police instructed them not to tell anyone about the intimidating mail, including their neighbors, family, and friends, because they were all now suspects. So the Brutus family were obviously taking their time to move in now. They weren't in any rush, right? And were understandably a little freaked out. So let's fast forward 2 weeks from when they got that first letter, and another letter arrives. This letter was even creepier and had details about the family, including their names, although misspelled, and their children's birth order and nicknames.
No.
Mm-mm.
The names of the family, like... And misspelled, I could be like, okay, some weirdo in the neighborhood. Yeah. Like, that wouldn't freak me out, but that wouldn't make my security feel breached. But the order of the kids and the nicknames, that's no.
The letter also referenced seeing their daughter painting on an easel on an enclosed porch space, asking, is she the artist in the family? I don't think so.
Get the fuck out.
Get the fuck out. So the letter continues. This is the second one. 657 Boulevard is anxious for you to move in. It has been years and years since the young blood ruled the hallways of the house.
What the fuck does that even mean?
I don't know. Have you found all of the secrets it holds yet? Will the young blood play in the basement, or are they too afraid to go down there alone? I would be very afraid if I were them. It is far away from the rest of the house.
All right, fucking nerd. Like, in your, like, Dungeons and Dragons bullshit. Like, get out of here.
Stop it.
Droms? My God. Droms.
If you are upstairs, you would never hear them scream. Will they sleep in the attic? Or will you all sleep on the second floor, who has the bedrooms facing the street? I'll know as soon as you move in. It will help me to know who is in which bedroom. Then I can plan better. All of the windows and doors in 657 Boulevard allow me to watch you and track you as you move through the house. Who am I? I am the watcher and have been in control of 657 Boulevard for the better part of 2 decades now. The Woods family turned it over to you. It was their time to move on and kindly sold it when I asked them to. I pass many times a day. 657 Boulevard is my job, my life, my obsession. And now you are too, Brutus family. Welcome to the product of your greed. Greed is what brought the past 3 families to 657 Boulevard, and now it has brought you to me. Have a happy moving in day. You know I will be watching. Signed, The Watcher.
So it's a nice house. And yeah, that's why, like, this person is obsessed with it, because it's like, well, what kind of people move into a nice house?
Well, it was like the house to move in. It was like the nicest house in the neighborhood, and it was a really nice neighborhood.
What a so fucking weird loser.
I hate him or her. So after that second letter, Derek and Maria obviously stopped bringing their kids to the house.
Duh.
Yeah. They were no longer sure when or if they would move in. Several weeks later, a third letter arrived.
Okay.
And it said, where have you gone to? 657 Boulevard is missing you. Ugh. So creepy.
Ew.
So by the end of the year, the investigation into who the watcher was had stalled. There was no digital trial, no fingerprints, and no suspects. Meanwhile, the stress was taking a mental toll on the Brutus family. Derek said that he was experiencing depression. Maria started going to therapy, and her therapist said she was experiencing symptoms of PTSD. Both parents were extremely paranoid. I mean, rightfully so.
Oh, of course. Yeah. As one should be.
Yeah. So 6 months after the letters arrived, they decided to sell the house. Due to some crazy rumors about the property, however, buyers were hesitant and they couldn't get anyone to buy this home. Because by this time, everyone knew.
Right.
So the Brutus family decides to sue the Woods family, the previous owners, for failing
for misrepresenting.
Yeah. Failing to disclose the threatening letter they had received right before they moved out. Remember, they didn't think it was a big deal. They just threw it away. A local reporter found out about this complaint, which included excerpts from the letters.
Sure.
And the media had a heyday. They loved it.
Field day. Just
for sure.
Yeah, what else is going to happen in that town? That's fresh news.
Hell yeah. So this small story became a viral sensation, causing a media frenzy around 657 Boulevard. So now the Brutus family was fucking screwed. There was no way anyone was buying this house. So they spoke with the developer about demolishing the entire home and building 2 houses on the lot.
That's how big the lot was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But just as luck would have it, the 2 plots would be less than 3 feet too small for the mandated size of the neighborhood. Less than 3 feet.
That sucks.
The Brutus family would appeal the ruling to the neighborhood planning board, who unanimously rejected the proposal. Maria was so upset and appealed the rejection, stating, "This is my town. I grew up here. I came back. I chose to raise my kids here. You all know what we have been through. You had the ability 2.5 years into a nightmare to make it a little better. And you have decided that this house is more important than we are."
It's been 2.5 years since it started. Mm-hmm. Fuck.
And it should be noted that in 2018, the Westfield Planning Board approved splitting up a different lot around the corner from 657 Boulevard that required a larger exception than the Brutus family requested.
And they approved it.
And they approved it.
So it's like, hey, it's 5 feet different.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that would make me livid.
Right? I would go fucking
wait,
crazy.
What year was all this happening?
So it started in 2014.
Okay.
And then, so 2.5 years later, they went to court and they tried to get that approved.
Right. Call it 2017.
2016 to 2017. And then a year later in 2018, someone else around the corner had gotten it approved and it was an even larger exception.
That's bullshit.
It is bullshit. So that Christmas, a few families that had openly rejected / protested the Brutus's plan received threatening hand-delivered letters that were signed Friends of the Brutus family. And we'll talk about more on this in a bit. So in the spring of 2016, 2 years after this whole thing started, the Brutus family finally found a family to rent their home. The family had 2 large dogs, adult children that were moved out of the house, and had a clause in their lease that let them out if there was another letter. Within 2 weeks of this new family moving in, a new letter arrives.
Because you know the first 2 weeks, it's like when you finally get all your stuff settled and unpacked and organized. Yeah. And like you get your like vase on your side table. Like yep. You get your flowers in. And the second it's like settled.
God damn it.
Come on. Rude.
Fucking sucks.
It takes me, I've moved so many times. It takes me weeks to move in.
I know, me too. I can't unpack in one day.
I can't get everything settled in one day, no.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this new letter that arrives 2 weeks after they move in. This is what it says. To the vile and spiteful Derek and his wrench of a wife, Maria. So you wonder who the watcher is? Turn around, idiots, the letter read. Maybe you even spoke to me, one of those so-called neighbors who has no idea who the watcher could be. Or maybe you do know and are too scared to tell anyone. Good move. I watched as you watched from the dark house in an attempt to find me. 657 Boulevard survived your attempted assault and stood strong with its army of supporters barricading its gates. My soldiers of the Boulevard followed my orders to a T. They carried out their mission and saved the soul of 657 Boulevard with my orders. All hail the Watcher.
Delusional.
Crazy.
Delusional. Like, this is somebody who lives in a fantasy world. Get a life. I said, Dungeons and Dragons world, and thinks that they are very important.
I don't even know. So the letter continues, and it continues to threaten the families. Maybe a car accident, maybe a fire, maybe something as simple as a mild illness that never seems to go away, but makes you fall sick day after day after day after day. Maybe the mysterious death of a pet. Loved ones suddenly die. Planes and cars and bicycles crash. Bones break. You are despised by the house and the watcher won. That's what the fucking letter says.
That's stupid.
So the renters were still in the house at the time and were spooked as fuck. But they agreed to stay if the Brodesses installed cameras around the house. And that was the last they had heard from the watcher. Okay. So let's talk about the suspects.
Okay.
So the first suspect is a teenage boy who grew up around the corner. Around 11 p.m. one night, while two detectives from the Westfield police were surveilling 657 Boulevard, a car suspiciously stopped outside the house. The car was traced to a young woman who lived in a town close by. The home of her boyfriend was on the same block as 657 Boulevard. The woman had told the police that her boyfriend was into some really dark video games, including one where he had played as a character called The Watcher. The Watcher. The teenage boy agreed to be questioned by the police, but he never showed up for his interview, and detectives did not have enough evidence to force him to come, so he was never questioned. And this is interesting too. There's also a different, I mean, I'm not a gamer, so I'm not really familiar, but there's also a game that's called The Witcher.
Isn't that like a thing on Netflix now?
I'm not sure.
With hot ass Henry Cavill that's like playing. It's called The Witcher.
So that could have been, I mean, it could have been just a coincidence and the detective could have heard him wrong and he might have been talking about that game.
Instead of saying The Watcher, he's The Witcher.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it.
So that's the first suspect. He was never questioned. So the second suspect is another neighbor, Michael Langford. Derek began to suspect Langford after meeting him at a neighborhood barbecue.
Is Derek the original guy that bought the house after the... Okay.
Yeah, Derek and his wife, Maria. Mm-hmm. So he began to suspect Langford after meeting him at a neighborhood barbecue shortly after receiving the first letter. Langford lived in the house next door, which belonged to his 90-year-old mother. Okay, this is really weird. So several of her adult children, all in their 60s, lived with her.
Ew.
Ew. And the family was seen as super strange, but very harmless. The Langfords had lived in the house since the 60s, which is when the watcher claimed that his father watched the house. Michael Langford's father had died about 12 years before the letter arrived, which is why the watcher could have claimed to have done the job of watching for the better part of two decades. Remember, that was in the mm-hmm. first letter. So according to his brother, Sandy Langford, Michael had been diagnosed with schizophrenia as a young man. He sometimes spooked newcomers to the neighborhood when he did strange things like walk through their backyard or peek into the windows of homes that were being renovated. No thanks.
If I looked up and saw somebody, my first gut feeling would be to run. Like, yeah. I wouldn't, like, fight or flight. Like, I'm a flyer.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get out.
Trust your instinct. Okay.
My instinct is to get the fuck out. GTFO. Hard.
So, going back to Michael Langford. Also worth noting, due to the positioning of the houses, Michael Langford would have had a perfect view of the easel they had set on the porch for their daughter. That the second letter referenced.
Right.
Okay. As investigators looked into the case, they discovered something surprising. Investigators had eventually conducted a DNA analysis on one of the envelopes that they had gotten and determined that the DNA belonged to a woman. Police decided to look more closely at Abby Langford, Michael's sister, who worked as a real estate agent.
Ugh.
Yeah. Was she upset about missing a commission right next door?
No, nobody's that shady.
She also worked at the local Lord and Taylor, and Chambliss coordinated with a security guard there to nab her plastic water bottle during a shift. So the investigators knew where she worked and they grabbed a water bottle to
DNA test, right. Or fingerprint.
Yep. But the investigator said that the DNA sample was not a match. Not long after, the prosecutor's office gave Derek and Maria some unexpected news. They wouldn't say why or how, but they had ruled out the Langsford as suspects completely.
Hmm.
But they never gave him a reason. Why not?
Aren't they supposed to? Or are you not?
I don't think you have to.
Obligated to. I
guess you're not. So this brings us to our third suspect, the Brodus family themselves.
What?
Mm-hmm. Some locals found it noteworthy that over the course of a decade, the Brodus's had upgraded from a $315,000 house to a $770,000 house to a $1.3 million house, and they had refinanced all of their mortgages. A few weeks after the letters became public, the Westfield Leader published an article in which anonymous neighbors were quoted asking why the Brodus's kept renovating a home they weren't moving into, or questioning whether they had really done that much renovating at all. The theory was that the Brodus's had suffered quote-unquote buyer's remorse, or realized that they couldn't afford the home and concocted an elaborate scheme to get out of the sale. Or that Derek was cooking up some sort of insurance fraud.
Mm.
Or that they were angling for a movie deal. So the Brodus's received several offers but turned them down. And then Lifetime eventually released a movie called The Watcher. So, even crazier. Remember those letters that I mentioned earlier that were signed friends of the Brodus family that went out after the Westfield Planning Committee rejected their proposal?
But to not the Watcher. Down?
No, it was friends of the Brodus' family. Well, those letters turned out to be written by Derek Brodus. Yeah.
Like 100%. Oh my God. Unequivocally written by them. Okay.
So Derek was confronted about this, and he claimed that those letters were the only anonymous letters that he has ever sent, and they were the result of years of frustration and psychological trauma.
I mean, I could believe...
I could believe that, too, because no one was doing anything. Nothing was getting fucking figured out.
So he's like, fine, then I'll just, like, tit for tat it and, like, try to get
scare some other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eyes on this.
Yeah. So a later investigation found that another family on the boulevard had also received a note from the Watcher around the time that the Brodus's received their first. Like the Woods family, the family had lived in the house for years without a problem and threw the letter away. So if the Brodus family was trying to get out of the home or get a movie deal, why would they send a letter to another house as well? And what makes this so interesting is the limited number of potential suspects. coupled with the complete lack of evidence that has halted investigators from making any progress. So since then, the Watcher has gone silent. We haven't heard from him again. But this is a really, I mean, this happened less than 2 years ago. We last heard from the Watcher less than 2 years ago. So he could definitely pop up again, and the case remains unsolved.
So is the house like still for sale? Like,
so that family, the ones that were renting it, are still there.
And they've gotten only one letter.
They've only gotten one letter. And you have to remember, like, the Brodus family was so desperate to leave and to rent it out. They were renting it out for less than their mortgage was.
So that's... Okay, that makes me not believe that it was from them.
Right. Yeah, me too.
So I think it was, honestly, like, I think it was that stupid teenage boy.
I think it was the Langfords.
You think so?
Well, I'm sorry, but they all live with their mother and they're in their 60s. That's so weird.
I think it's a boredom thing.
You do?
I think it's a, like, I could see it as a possessive, like, we don't like new neighbors, like, kind of thing. So maybe I'm on your side now. Like, maybe it was the Linkfords, because I see it as, like, we've been here for freaking mm-hmm. ever. We have nothing else good to do. Yeah,
we're losers.
Losers. Mm-hmm. Why? But my question is, why can't they figure this out? This Me seems too. Like a very simple thing to figure out.
There's got to be, like, did they really do enough DNA testing? Like, fingerprints, right? Isn't that...
I bet this is not on... Well, but what else? I would like to see the docket of cases on the detective's desks at this, like, right? Little rural, like, quintessential. Like, what else do you have to do?
I
like,
mean, but that murders? All goes back to maybe they're so used to nothing happening. They're just unexperienced.
Yeah.
Inexperienced, not unexperienced.
Oh, I didn't even.
Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy.
Could you imagine getting a letter like that?
I have heard of that. I have heard of this, but I forgot all of those details. I forgot where I heard about it, but I didn't know it was still unsolved. I thought it was like had a conclusion.
Yeah, no updates.
I know. Weird, right?
So always check your mail.
I don't.
I don't either.
I never check my mail.
I never get letters like that. I would freak the fuck out.
Oh, I would immediately move. Like, I wouldn't even try to fight. I'd be like, hey, baby, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah.
Ew, I don't want somebody.
And the house was built in 1905.
So my parents live in a house that was built in 1916. But, like, there's no weirdos about, like, it just, like I said earlier, like, a house is a house no matter when it's built.
Right.
What makes an old house different besides the people that get attached to it? So it's always a people problem. It's not a house problem.
No.
You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, unless there's a ghost that lives there, but I don't think this is a ghost. I don't think a ghost can type something on a computer. That'd be very impressive.
That would be super so impressive.
Crazy.
So great. All right, guys. Well, so this is a doozy, but yeah, just don't trust your family, I guess.
Yeah, you really can't. You can't trust fucking anyone. Trust no one.
That's right.
That's right.
All right. Well, we love you.
We love you. God bless.
And again, trust no one. Bye.
Bye.